Welcome to the Great Base Tennis Podcast. This is your co-host, Andy Pitzel, alongside Steve Smith. This week's episode, we're talking about Dennis Vandermeer, episode 43.
Time marches on. Dennis Vandermeer, amazing, amazing, amazing Dennis Vandermeer.
Yeah.
One of the pillars, we're on pillar number seven.
Pillars of the Great Base.
Yeah, so certainly Dennis, amazing. How many times could I say that word, amazing? With a great base, just think of Dennis Vandermeer. For my notes, I read one article, prepare for this podcast, and spent less than a half an hour reading about Dennis. Mm-hmm. We have so much material on Dennis in our library to research, although I really don't have to. Because being a trench pro, being out there every day teaching,
yeah,
there's just so many skills that I've learned from Dennis Vandermeer, the ideas, the concepts. He was born in 1933, died in 2019, died at the age of 86, suffered a stroke. Almost the last 10 years of his life, he simply was not himself. Mm. His wife, Pat, and the entire PTR family, the Professional Tennis Registry, organization for tennis teachers that Dennis founded, you know, assisted him in the remaining years of his life. I always think of Dennis as South African, but he's a native of Namibia, a small country in West Africa. Mm. His parents were missionaries. He started tennis at the age of six. He didn't start on a tennis court. His mother would find a dried out patch of dirt, use two sticks as net posts, and toss some balls.
Yeah.
The net was a string. The little ball machine called the Twister.
Yeah, tennis twist.
Dennis Vandermeer. Oh, what an amazing guy. Showman. So, phenomenal teacher. But he called those twisters a little ball machine because they reminded him of his mother who...
His little mother.
Late mother who would pitch him tennis balls.
Yeah.
His parents eventually left the nomadic lifestyle being missionaries, and they moved to Johannesburg. Dennis began to be formally taught. In other words, he took lessons from tennis teaching professionals. He mm-hmm. became one of the best juniors in South Africa. At the age of 19, Dennis, and he told this story often, he had a tryout to be a playing member of the Davis Cup team, South African Davis Cup.
Yeah.
And he choked. He just told the story about how he choked.
Yeah.
I've
read that some people would say, oh, it's a good thing that he did because then he became, you know, one of the best teachers. If he hadn't have choked, maybe you wouldn't have had Dennis Vandermeer, the teacher.
Right. I think of Dennis as an Afrikaner. He came to the United States. His name was Dennis Merva. If I'm pronouncing that, changed it to Dennis Vandermeer.
I think you're proving the point. I don't know how to pronounce it either.
It would be mispronounced for sure.
It's like Brett Favre. You know that movie, Something About Mary?
Yeah.
What's Brett Favre doing here?
I heard from a South African today. How would you say Petrus Kookiemoore?
Yeah, Kookiemoore. That's how I would say it. I don't know. Petrus is listening, which I'm sure he is at some point. Hopefully we did that justice.
I was with him one time, and this gentleman, you know, he said, yeah, I'm Petrus. And of course, the way he pronounced it, the guy goes, well, Pete, it's good to meet you.
Because it's kind of like Petrus. Yeah.
With, but Dennis certainly liked the sound. It ended in a strong syllable. We have a young Canadian boy here who's a very good tennis player, Hayden Malik. And I love to just call him. Of course, we have another boy called Aiden, so just call him by his last name.
Yeah, Malik.
Malik. You think of our great base, there's two South Africans, Dennis Vandermeer and Bill Jacobson. So 25%, you know, two out of four. I've trained many
South Africans.
Yeah, I've trained many South African coaches, many South African players. I've been to South Africa. Very respectful of the culture, the Afrikaners.
Hey, you've played with lions.
Yes, I had a choice one time to. I was with
you were rubbing the belly of a lion.
With Petrus and his wife, family
wrestling.
So, as a tune-up, before we went to Kruger Park. Mm-hmm. We were at a small Kruger Park, and so as my host, he said, there's a 14-foot snake, and as my host, being so polite, he said, would you like to have an encounter with the snake? I said, well, what does that mean? He goes, well, I'll just pay a fee and then you can have your photo taken with a snake around you. And I said, well, are there any other options? And he said, yes, you could feed a lion. And I said, well, I'll do that. This would never happen in America. I had to fill out paperwork. And then the gentleman said, well, let's feed them first. I said, I think that's a good idea. Yeah. And seriously, they have a male, female, and the area that they were in, it's like they took a big turkey. It was like 20 pounds of meat and threw one over the fence first. And there's a fight.
Yeah.
And then 2 seconds later, threw the other one over.
Yeah.
But I actually had a choice between the old lion or four cubs. And I looked at it and I said, I'll take the old lion.
Yeah.
And so anyway, maybe I should go forward more on Dennis, but this is an African story where the gentleman told me, he goes, and a big guy, he said, you'll just stand behind me and we'll be giving the lion, it was like a big container of milk.
Yeah.
And some concoction. And he said, he's just interested in the beverage.
Yeah.
He's just interested in the milk. He's going to take his paw and put it on your foot. And he's just telling you, because, you know, the trainer, you know, he got out of the way. So it looked like I was there by myself.
And yeah, exactly.
He said, the lion will put his paw on your foot. He's just telling you that you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And then right before the container's empty, he goes, you'll just slip out. And I said, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress. But the discipline, I think the Roger Federer success story, I think so a big part of that is his mother is an Afrikaner, the discipline and the respect. When asked why South African juniors, there's so many years and years ago that were just world-class players, you know, why they didn't cut it and make it all the way to the pro level, Dennis added to that answer, you know, one thing would be the distance that South Africans had to travel. And they were just so far away from the, you know, on the other side of the world, they were so far away from the highest levels of competition. The financial costs, the exchange rate between the rand, the South African rand, the U.S. dollar was so extreme.
Yeah.
But Dennis said the parents of the Afrikaners, they had too much discipline and their children were sometimes suppressed.
Yeah. Loosen up a little bit.
Another way to mention that, the parents were too authoritative. And their children felt like they were not allowed to make mistakes.
Yeah.
I told that to one South African. Goes, yeah, now I know it's my parents' fault.
Yeah.
So, no, you don't need to twist and turn that. But Dennis, like Lynette Federer, you know, they're South Africans that have spent most of their time in another country. You know, with respect, it varies from one place to another, from one family to another. It varies from one topic to another. For example, people have discipline for academics and sometimes not for sports or vice versa.
But you're going to learn from mistakes, right? I mean, I just think of, you know, you go, hey, the stove is hot. But then, you know, you really learn by you when you touch the hot stove and you go, oh, that's hot.
Yeah, you say
you get the burn.
In Japan, a lot of time teaching tennis in Japan, and I think the Japanese, too much respect. I can remember one time meeting with Munehiro Yoshida at the tennis training center in Chiba. And you know, we're in his office till after midnight. And I came out and everyone was still there. And I said, they whispered, why is everyone still here? And they said, you don't go home till the boss goes home.
Yeah.
In the U.S., I think we're going on the other side of that where there's too little. In working with Afrikaners, impressed with their manners and their work ethic, Dennis Vandermeer. Great manners, great work ethic. Mm. For example, it's Steve, Uncle Steve, Coach Steve. They would never just call me Steve.
Yeah.
Roger Federer's mother, Lynette, one of our students, Raven Claussen, a South African, was addressing Lynette and called her Tani, which is for the man and Tani for the woman. Like, and then very quickly she said,
like grandma?
She said, no, I'm not that old. Don't Tawny me.
Yeah.
But a new pursuit, you know, after Dennis choked in the Davis Cup tryout, his coach at the time suggested that Dennis teach tennis to help himself with his confidence. And I think that's something that we do quite a bit. The highest form of retention for learning is to teach. Mm-hmm. The teacher always learns more than the student. But in peer teaching, it certainly gives a student confidence. And Dennis was okay with confidence as far as his presentation skills. But through that, when he started teaching, Dennis found his calling. He never really looked back. And he's so fortunate at such a young age that, you know, where his parents were missionaries for education, he became a missionary for tennis. Mm-hmm. He moved to the U.S. in 1961. He was 28 years old, 27, 28. To reflect upon his tennis teaching genius, it's very interesting. Learning the game in a setting that did not provide a tennis court, I think that has a lot to do with the hunger for Dennis. You know, passion was second to none. He was born into a life where he was constantly observing teachers, his parents, and the challenges they faced with underfunded situations. Mm-hmm. You know, South Africans, it used to be a requirement to be in the military. So Dennis certainly said that he learned a lot. He's just so outstanding with group dynamics, but it was a mandatory requirement. Obviously, playing skills. There's just so many things that made Dennis really the total package.
Yeah.
YouTube, looking back at film, doesn't really, I think, do justice to those who are so fortunate, like myself, spent so much time around him. Great speaker, funny, tireless worker, highly intelligent, hungry for knowledge. Adding to his knowledge with something even greater is imagination. I believe off the Myers-Briggs we talked about on a previous podcast that Dennis was an ENTJ, which, as you know, knowing more about that than I do, that he was a CEO, that he could not lead. Born leader, I would say that Dennis needed to be out in front. But at the same time, you know, he's always bringing in experts, always bringing in speakers, and he was certainly in the back of the room. He was not going to miss a presentation. Definitely a pioneer in the tennis teaching field. To review, Anise an extrovert. So Dennis got his energy from people. The opposite is an introvert. Dennis, the next, is an N, a preference. So EN, intuitive. The letter I's already been used. Dennis definitely saw the big picture. He was a global thinker, more for the future than for the moment. T is for thinking. You know, people are born with both preferences in each category. So feelers can think and thinkers can feel. But Dennis was always, always thinking. J, I think Dennis loved structure. But, you know, you have to think, okay, a lot of times, where does that come from? It's just how people grow up. And
yeah, military.
With
Afrikaner discipline.
Yeah, just the times. The level of obedience that was demanded. You know, and I think even back for myself growing up in Catholic school, the nuns were in charge.
Yeah.
And if they cracked you over your knuckles, the parents were clapping.
Yeah.
You know, now it's, you know, now the tail's wagging the dog. It's just changed. It's not children's fault, but throughout society, especially here in this country. Make an understatement, his organizational skills were a sight to behold. But I do think one could argue that Dennis was an ENTP, which is a planner. So the three preferences, ENT, but the P being for perceiving, being very flexible, easygoing, having fun, not really that rigid. He certainly didn't have a rigid personality by any means.
Yeah.
So he could have been an ENTP. An ENTP is a planner, where the ENTJ is a CEO. Either way, to study Dennis Vandermeer, one should know the strengths of being an ENTJ and ENTP. So yeah, go ahead.
Go back and listen to our podcast on brain typing.
Yes, mine is D-U-M-B.
D-U-M-B, capitals, capital letters.
Yes. 1961, when he came to the United States, he spent time with John Gardner. You know, he had the Berkeley Tennis Club actually did the paperwork where he could come in. But John ran tennis clinics and camps all across America. Probably they were his programs were primarily based at really posh resorts. I had the opportunity one time in Scottsdale, Arizona, to go observe a Gardner camp. He wanted his pros to play backgammon, bridge, and chess. They needed to be able to socialize. They would wear blue blazers in the evening. Gardner, remember, had a camp one time. It was for U.S. senators only. But Dennis was brought up old school, and certainly he could adapt, successfully interact with all types of people, the people skills, the social skills. But that was just an experience that Dennis had. Mm-hmm. The Berkeley Tennis Club, you know, Tom Stowe was there, at the time was looked upon as being one of the best tennis teachers. He taught Don Budge. Don Budge, who won the Grand Slam in 1938.
Mm-hmm.
So again, Stowe was considered by some to be the very best, a title that Dennis aspired to. Dennis definitely was interested in being the best tennis teacher in the world. Mm-hmm. It's a title that Billie Jean King gave Dennis with a testimonial that's on the cover of his book, The Complete Book of Tennis, is just that. Dennis Vanier is the best tennis teacher in the world, Billie Jean King. In 1973, Dennis coached Billie Jean King. Most famous match ever played, most watched tennis match ever played, Battle of the Sexes, Billie Jean King versus Bobby Riggs. It was played in the Astrodome. Dennis was on the courtside bench coaching Billie.
Yeah.
Now, I was disappointed in the recent movie about the famous match that they had Billie Jean's husband, Larry King, on the courtside bench. So when the match was being played, it was portrayed that her husband was on the bench coaching her.
And he wasn't there at all, like as far as on the bench?
Dennis was on the bench.
But I mean, was Larry there as well?
Or? Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
They just didn't include.
Definitely.
They just didn't include
Larry, Dennis. Larry, yeah, the movie, I think, is very, very well done. And Larry certainly had so much to do with, you know, the psyche or the promotion and everything with the match. But Dennis was the on-court coach.
Yeah.
Dennis went into business one time with Billie. I believe their company was called Tennis America, which the purpose was to improve tennis teaching, declared bankruptcy. In 1976, Dennis started the Vandermeer Tennis University.
Yeah.
And again, this is just sitting down, writing some notes. But at that time, you know, he traveled all over the U.S. and then had monies to move his base from California in Berkeley. He bought land back east. He bought land in beautiful Hilton Head Island. And, you know, so in 77, he had a home base and he founded the Professional Tennis Registry. Initially known as the USPTA, the United States Professional Tennis Registry.
I think now USPTR.
PTR. So yeah. They changed it from USPTR to PTR because it's so international. I think they have 16,000 members, 125 countries.
So I was saying last week when we were talking about tennis certifications that the PTR seems so much more international, although you said that the USPTA is kind of an international certification. I just didn't
at one point where we talked about certifications, we had the record for testing so many people one time, you know, the worldwide record. But I know with the USPTA, the Japanese were very close.
Yeah.
So, okay. But no, PTR definitely more international.
Yeah.
But the USPTA definitely just with their connection with Japanese coaches. So they're international as well. It's not one is and one isn't, but yeah, I'd say agree that the PTR is more international.
Yeah.
So basically to me, it's a governing body of tennis. They're leading tennis teachers, but it's not a federation.
Yeah.
At Hilton Head, Dennis ran an all encompassing program for adults, children, and coaches. I was with Dennis one time at the Orange Bowl, and I was also with Robbie Seguzo. So Robbie was my boss. He mm-hmm. made a few pennies on the pro tour, and he bought a place in Boca Raton. And I remember Dennis saying, "Steven, it's not going to work. He should be working for you, but you're working for him." but with Dennis, you know, just leading the way with what he did at Hilton Head Island. I remember telling Robbie, "Let's get on an airplane, let's get in the car, and let's travel to Hilton Head and watch what Dennis is doing.
Yeah.
You're going to have the facility in Boca where you need to teach adults, you need to teach children, you need to teach special interest groups, you need to teach coaches.
Yeah.
But at that time, and I still think it's very much that way, is people want to be in academy, you know, where I don't think of Dennis Vandermeer, his facility, although he eventually started the Vandermeer Academy.
Yeah.
But again, all encompassing. 1977, 78, I traveled to a place called Walden on the Lake, a tennis community outside of Houston. And that's where I first watched Dennis Vandermeer. And anytime anybody who watched him for the first time, if you're zoned in on tennis teaching, it is a wow factor, or was a wow factor. Vandermeer on court. I say bigger than life, a showman, entertainer, educator, master of capturing the audience. So my first opportunities to learn from him was just being part of a three-day weekend. Think back, you know, Dennis was 44, I was 22. The tennis university would follow, so the first weekend was open for people could just come on for the 3 days. And then tennis university used to be a 10-day program, and then every evening you'd have students come out for free clinics. And so he was spreading the tennis gospel. By the end of the week, you know, he'd have all these students that would be there to serve as guinea pigs for the testers.
Right. So this was part of the certification then? PTR certification?
Yeah. Again, 77 is when it first started. So 77, yeah. I went. I didn't take the exam. I was in a position where time-wise, where I could go all 10 days. It was, again, 10 days. It was cut down. Remember, the price remained the same for a long time, but it was cut down in the number of days. Mm. Dennis never had children, so that nomadic lifestyle, just traveling all over to initially get the PTR up and running was easir for him. Mm. His first wife, Linda, excellent tennis player. Side note, I mean, she was taught by Welby Van Horn. It's interesting the connections that people have. I remember asking Dennis, what other tennis teacher should we study? And he mentioned one. He mentioned Welby Van Horn.
You think she influenced him a little bit?
No, for sure.
Like, I mean, taught him some things, showed him some things, I'm sure.
No, for sure. It's like, you know, how does Welby do it? I mean, what's the Welby method? What's the secret? Anybody at that time, like, you know, with Welby, and we talked about him, Arthur Ashe said you could tell a Welby Van Horn student from a mile away.
Yeah.
But back then, I think tennis teaching, the forehand, years and years ago, people were wrong on the forehand side. You know, I think Vandermeer, they would talk about Braden next as a pillar. You know, it was looked upon as Star Wars, like so futuristic, even so wrong to close your racket face on the forehand side.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was penny on edge and 180 degree swing, you know, shake hands in the backswing, shake hands in the follow through.
Yeah.
So the forehand's really changed, but it was when we talked to Scott Perelman, one of the coaches at the University of Florida, Bill Timm's name came up. There's so many similarities between Bill Timm and Vic Braden. But back then it was like, okay, there is a ready position. Everyone, do we agree that there's a ready position?
Yeah.
Do we agree that there's a unit turn? Is there a backswing? You know, does the racket go low? Is it inside? Do we agree that there's a contact point? Can we agree that there's a hitting zone? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's just all that common sense has just gone away.
Yeah.
We're going to turn the doorknob. We're going to have a windshield wiper. We're going to, how do you say it? Flip it, snap it, crack it.
Yeah. Keep going. Bop it, twist it, pull it, roll it, wing it, sling it.
Yeah, so I was tested in 1979. Not many people could say that I was tested by Dennis. He really, for the most part, didn't test. But I went first, and all the other attendees, so I'm 24 years old at this time, it's 2 years later, is...
you had been one of the younger ones in, right? I mean, how many... I mean, I went through the USPTA when I was, you know, my early 20s. 21 maybe or something, but what was the average age there? I mean,
yeah, I would have definitely been one of the younger ones, for sure. Probably only one there living in a van, and at the same time, you know, playing tournaments. I lived in a van for 2 years, and should have a podcast on being a van man.
You should write a book about it. Just call it Down by the River.
Yeah. Yeah, so many stories. Wayne Sabin, top 10 player in the world, knocking on the window every morning. Great way to beat the rent with selected for to be tested by Dennis for a number of reasons. I think a former hockey player, I think he entertained the idea of putting me in the penalty box, blowing the whistle.
Yeah.
And it sounded like a flock of birds. It was just boom, 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 whistle, tweet, tweet, tweet.
He coached with a whistle, right?
That's his biggest, that was his biggest tool.
And did Welby?
No.
Yeah. So, I mean, you don't see that very often. I know you do. I've done it in the past with big groups.
With, yeah.
Kind of a necessity if you do large groups, but that is.
Well, if you're a police officer, if you're a traffic cop, there's certain situations, but Dennis taught masses of people.
Yeah.
Dennis, it's in the notes. He didn't really like private lessons. He's because he could teach so well and so fast. He said, well, you know, I'm going to get him to hit the ball better in 5 minutes. So then I don't want to babysit him for 55 minutes.
Yeah.
So we have all this information with Dennis in our library, but there's one book, it's called The Tennis Clinic. And it's, I think every time he ran a clinic, it's like, okay, this could be a book, this could be a movie, but The Tennis Clinic, it just covers a clinic from beginning to end.
Yeah.
That's a stretch to say I was a ghostwriter for Dennis, but I did write for Dennis. You know, I grew up in a small town where one of my friends, his father, Bob Drum, he made his living by being Arnold Palmer's ghostwriter. So no, I just remember that. It's like, okay, I wrote that and it says by Dennis Vandermeer.
So you were.
But yeah, to, go through a little deeper on ghostwriting is I really felt that high school tennis really needed to be improved and have a feeder system. So you're coaching this high school, what junior high is feeding into that high school, what elementary schools feed into the junior highs.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dennis had two businesses. You know, he had the Tennis University or Vandermeer Tennis, which was a profit based, but then the PTR was, nonprofit. You know, he eventually had a full-time person working as a writer. I believe going way back, Dennis Malik was his name. Nice guy. I spent time with Dennis. But so there were the two Dennises. But I wrote a three-part series with the motive of helping high school tennis. And I submitted to the USPTA, the PTR, and the USTA. And by the time I did that, I was a member of the USPTA, PTR, lifetime member of the USTA. And this is not, you know, throwing anybody on the bus, but at that time, the USPTA, they never responded. The USTA told me they were already doing that. They were already doing all these things to build high school tennis. But Dennis, the USPTA contacted me, which meant at that time, Dennis contacted me. And this is where he was just so proactive and so much energy. I remember at one point, a small college in Arizona was going to produce three videos. And it went back and forth, and you know, the production opportunity fell through, but so the private sector of Dennis's business eventually produced the three parts. There was a major effort to distribute the tapes for high school coaches. One was Essential Strokes, the other one was Tactics, the other one was Practice.
Are those still available anywhere, do you think?
Essential Strokes is online. It's on YouTube. With, you know, I think our listeners, the archives, I know that Nick Valtteri is doing that now. There's so many things from the past is that I think that people need to go back. That's the whole thing about the Great Bays is we're carrying the torch for these tennis teachers from the past. I would think if through the PTR, they would definitely be available.
Yeah. I was, you know, in preparation for this, I was watching some of Dennis's old tapes from your library. And, you know, even just structuring a lesson, you know, there's stuff in there where it's just like, okay, you know, every teaching pro should know that, you know, here's the beginning, you're going to teach the core information, and then here's what should happen in the second part of the lesson is you give people individual instruction and then keep the group busy, and he gives examples of all that, and then he wraps it up with, hey, you need to have homework and ways to practice, and it's just like, here's the three parts of a tennis lesson. I think it's really, that kind of stuff's really valuable, you know, regardless of what someone may be teaching or not. It's just like, hey, here's a way to structure things.
Oh, Dennis had his critics. To avoid criticism, say nothing, do nothing, be nothing. I think so much of that was just pure jealousy is that, you know, he was just a cut above when it came down to organization and how to teach. let me just keep going with this. We'll get into that. Dennis preferred to have 36 students in his class with a waiting list. Although, again,
in a group lesson, you mean?
Yeah. So coming back to the whistle, he was a master at mass teaching, but so for him, 36 people was nothing. Never seen anyone who compares to Dennis when it comes to group dynamics. So again, yeah, just needs the whistle, important tool.
Yeah.
Could teach 100 people in a parking lot by himself. And they'd all love it, and they'd all learn. Yeah. Pretty soon they would all have a very good service motion. Yeah. They would understand what the volley is.
Yeah.
In our office, we just refer to Dennis as DVM, Dennis Vandermeer. Books and manuals and handouts, audio cassettes, and all, you know, all the videos. And when I got around to having this opportunity to run an academic program, it's just nonstop how much Dennis Vandermeer helped us with that. To start a clinic, Dennis would have his staff run a warm-up and stretch. During that time, Dennis would learn all the participants' names, everybody's name. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would really say 100 names, no problem. That's something that I've learned from Dennis. I mean, I can do that. You know, okay, 15-minute stretch, I can learn 100 people's names.
Yeah.
First names.
Process was if there are people in different areas where you walk up to someone and you go, hey, I'm Fred. And you go, hey, Fred. Okay, now over here, I've got Fred, Tom, Dennis, and you know Larry. And then you just go to the next person. All right, I got this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, right? You just walk around and kind of
Digress on names, I mean, if you're going to run a seminar, so you go and you talk to 50 coaches, say, okay, let's just do this. You're there for 3 days. And the person who's sitting in the 50th chair has the greatest challenge.
Yeah.
So the person in the first chair just stands up. Hi, I'm Tom. And the second person stands up and says, this is Tom and I'm Betty. And they sit down and you just keep going. And people can learn the names. It's repetition.
Right.
It's also confidence.
Yeah.
But you have to do it.
And wanting to.
Wanting to do it. But it's a must. You know, learning someone's name is music to their ears. But also, hey, you know, Charlie, you're about to step on that tennis ball.
Yeah.
I remember one time I was with Vic Brady in a social setting. And he said, Steve, why don't you introduce everybody? But I had just sat in the corner, was talking to this one person about, I don't know, ice hockey. Who knows what we were talking about? So, but because I would go in and he'd say, all right, Steve, why don't you, because that was just a skill I had. But I learned that from Dennis. Mm-hmm. But Dennis took wowing and captioning his audience to a level that's unmatched. He would have in the beginning, he'd have each player serve filmed. Okay. Then, so he knew everyone's name. You go in the classroom, he wouldn't even look behind him. He wouldn't look at the monitor. So not only did he know the names, he knew the order in which they were filmed. Now that means it's like, you know, you can't make this stuff up.
They weren't sitting in an order or anything?
No. So then, I mean, and his longtime assistant, Louis Capps, not even going to stop the tape. And, in other words, it's just a flow to it. Mm-hmm. And he would very quickly, you know, so, you know, here comes Bill, you know, Bill tosses too high and you can see how he bends at the waist. And, so again, not looking at the monitor seriously, and he'd be looking straight ahead and he would be able to mimic the quirks of each person's service motion. And certainly there's a lot more in the service motion than there would be in any other stroke because they go through the ritual, they bounce the ball. But again, his analytical eye and all the idiosyncrasies, he should have it down. And then he would go through the flaw, the cause of the flaw and the cure. And he would do that boom, boom, boom. And then the next person would come up.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like toast. I mean,
too bad there's not a film of that.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, there's people like Dan Santorum and Julie Gilley. And as I mentioned, Louis Capp. His wife Helmy, that I'm sure they have some of that on tape, but the quality of the film probably wouldn't be that good. So he'd have the class in the palm of his hand. I mean, you could only hear Dennis in his unique voice. Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Dennis Vandermeer. Mm-hmm. So he created an awe factor. That's why when I'm ever around anyone, certainly all these years gone by, if they would criticize Dennis, I would just say, I would simply ask a person, have you ever seen him in person? Have you ever watched him work? Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, that's just the way it works. That's the lay of the land. There's going to be critics.
Sure.
But there's two, I think there's, you know, that high caliber, his standard of excellence. I think that happens in all walks of life. You're basically either going to be respected or resented.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, I just know tennis. You know, I have just been in a tennis bubble, but you know, I would think that it's very similar in other ways, other walks of life.
Sure.
You know, I would say this, you know, have I ever met a tennis teacher with a competency level to even think about criticizing Dennis Vandermeer? I have no problem. I mean, just really, you know, confrontation I think is okay. Did you really say that? And I'd say, I don't think I've ever met someone with a competency level to even think about criticizing Dennis Vandermeer. Mm-hmm. I mean, he would just make the internet gurus today, their heads would just spin with our typical conference pro. That's not to beat the people up today, but it's like, you know, I think Dave Anderson mentioned it in one of our podcasts. A theme for tennis would be from the movie Back to the Future.
Yeah. Well, I would even say half of the, not half, but there's a chunk of internet teachers that were trained by you. So there's a lot of young guys, you know, that didn't necessarily go through the trench work that Dennis had already gone through, you know, mm-hmm. being in your 40s, 50s and starting the PTR, things like that. He'd already had all that experience.
Oh, you know, Dennis, something you hear him say, it's, you know, I think the dubious pleasure of, you know, you're somebody who worked with Manuel Santana or Margaret Court, Billie Jean King, the dubious pleasure of working with the best tennis players in the world, but also the worst tennis players in the world.
The toes, yeah.
And I think they should have tournaments, okay? Who can teach the beginners the fastest? And, you know, someone's going to get lucky and they're going to get a beginner who's, you know, played some other sports or they're very skilled.
Yeah.
They're very athletic, coordinated. You know, you might get the kid who's got two left shoes and Coke bottle glasses and, as Vic Braden would say, they put the ice cream in the middle of their forehead. If you can teach that kid how to play.
Yeah.
But I think that's a major problem. We've touched upon that in these podcasts is people, you know, they sidestep skipping the beginners, not Dennis Vandermeer.
Yeah.
In our school of thought, we obviously have a high level of respect for Braden. There was a few points from a technical side that where Braden had, you know, he had a better handle on technique. Mm-hmm. But if you think back, I mean, we were all wrong about the forehand. You know, so now, I mean, tennis is just stuck on the forehand. You know, it's not like it goes on to anything else. Are people talking about the forehand return? Are they talking about forehand approach shot? Yeah. It's just the forehand. Yeah. You know, it's not the serve, the overhead. I was just watching Tsitsipas play a little bit on TV. And, I mean, old school game.
Yep.
You know, it's not racket on edge on the forehand. But no, I think it's, you know, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. But I would always voice negative comments. People would be negative towards Dennis. Mm. But that's just the way it works. I think jealousy, the more you accomplish.
Yeah.
There are far more similarities between Braden and Vandermeer. I would tell my students if they had the chance to watch Vandermeer work, then they would know. I mentioned that. So artist, specialist, expert. If there was a list of the greatest tennis teachers of all time, I used to introduce Dennis this way, like there are for players. Dennis was a labor. Mm. You could say Dennis was a Federer. Mm. I mean, he was that good.
He's going to go into the International Tennis Hall of Fame.
Yes, that's great, this summer. A couple of years ago, I attended the USTA player development course, and one of the speakers was looking for a YouTube clip. And a short film from YouTube of Dennis popped up. And the speaker said, "That's so 70s. And I didn't say anything. I was hoping that he just meant because the shorts were so short.
Yeah.
But I hope the comment was not directed towards Dennis for being outdated. You know, you have to go back 70s. Okay, that's 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But, and I certainly was grateful to learn a few things during my time with the UST High Performance course. Although there's no comparison between that product, the UST high performance course, and being trained by Vandermeer. I mean, you know, that's where people need to go back to the future.
Yeah.
Training session with Dennis, he'd offer the nuts and bolts. In other words, the technique. And I'm talking about some subtleties, some nuances. It's, you know, to compare Braden to Vandermeer, it was not like they were just, just polar opposites, by any means when it came to technique. X's and O's, a strategy. There was never anyone standing around with Dennis. There's always a theme that he could incorporate. Dennis taught information. I think what's more important is that he taught applied information.
Yeah.
I mean that, okay, here's information, but now here's how you apply it.
Yeah, here's how to practice it.
Right. Dennis would use the comment that the PTR, the standard method, the official standard method, was biomechanically sound. He did work with Stanley Pleganoff, a pioneer in the field of biomechanics, someone that I know you've talked about quite a bit, and refer to his work all the time as Howard Brody.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis understood tennis academics, but more importantly, he delivered tennis academics. I mean, it was fun, it was finesse, it was fundamentals all in one. Mm-hmm. I think like Einstein, if one knows their subject matter, one can explain it to a six-year-old.
Yeah, we were talking about, maybe it was in one of your stories, just doctoral jargon. And I see a lot of that online. I've definitely been guilty of it at times, but you get a lot of that. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how, okay, now can you explain that to a six-year-old or an eight-year-old? Sometimes we just want to get fancy to impress people.
Yeah, the $14
just,
words,
just to make it
the doctoral
simple.
Jargon.
Yeah.
You know what an expert is? Used to say an expert is someone from out of town with a slideshow.
Right.
Dennis used to teach his audience to say caca de toros. Now, I know you
caca
don't.
Caca de toros.
We don't swear on the podcast, but let's use the word sugar. Sugar of the bull.
Bull sugar.
Caca de toros. And then, bull sugar. So just think that the consumer, mom and dad, bringing their child level tennis or entry level adult, people need to have a BS detector.
Right.
And that's where I don't think people in tennis do necessarily. Anything goes. 2 + 2 = 5.
Yeah. A lot of, video these days on the cell phones has brought about a lot of practice footage.
I think
and
a three.
It's confused and misinterpreted and misunderstood.
I think of three individuals quite often that have passed away, Vic Braden, Welby Van Horn, and Vic Braden. By the time I was 26, 40 years ago, I'd been taught to
Dennis.
I said it wrong.
Welby, and who's the third one? Dennis.
That's why you have to hold my hand.
Trying to help.
Slow down. Yeah, Vic Braden, thank you. Welby Van Horn and Dennis Vandermeer.
Yeah.
So 26 years ago, I should say, now I'm really confused. I hope I'm not confusing anybody else.
No, we got it.
It's 40 years ago. I was taught by these three individuals.
Yeah.
And I really think, and I don't want to be doom and gloom, but it's really sad what's going on in tennis teaching. Tennis teaching needs a shot in the arm. Fundamentals, basics, building a foundation, the whole process of developing an all-court game, singles and doubles.
Yeah.
Certainly, Vandermeer was an artist. Like stay static balance, for example. Of course, that was something that Welby would do one-on-one. We went through that in a podcast on Welby. So you might take three lessons and not hit one ball. Mm. You had a young player out here the other day, and his mother said, he just told me that he only hit 7 balls. And I said, well, that was 7 too many. That was 7 too many. I mean, you've got to learn how to hang onto the racket.
Yeah.
The grip of a lifetime.
People say all the time, I've never done anything like this before.
The grip determines the angle of the racket face. The angle of the racket face determines the angle of the racket path.
Yeah.
And then, kids are just going to avoid the net. I mean, their racket goes from their nose to their shoelaces. Doesn't go forward, it just goes straight down.
Yeah.
Because if they go forward, the ball's going long.
Yep.
But you things like ready position, I mentioned backswing, contact, follow through. These terms are heard less and less. In 1981, I flew to Hilton Head Island. By that time, I was at Tyler Junior College, Tyler, Texas. Mm. And I'm a PTR member, and I make arrangements. I'm going to come and work as a volunteer for a week. And my mission was just to sit down with Dennis, talk to him about this tennis teaching curriculum, and have Dennis put us on a schedule And he really put us on the map. I think a Peter Burwash on his own accord came to see us first, just right. called me up and said, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And so Dennis and his wife, Pat, and a handful of other pros came each spring. And Dennis, the word pillar is very good. In addition to Dennis and his wife and his staff coming out, he helped us with another group of educators. We have talked about Jim Lair, had a podcast on Jim, and Jim Verdick. We consider those two pillars. Jim Verdick, tennis coaching. Jim Lair, mental toughness. Greg Presutto, Dennis used to call him the munchkin. He wrote a book on tennis munchkins, early childhood development. Bill McKenzie, he always began and ended his lectures with something from the Kingston Trio. But Bill McKenzie on salesmanship, just selling tennis, the business of tennis. Mm. You know, he helped our program so much. We had a scholarship that was funded by the PTR. Mm. And Craig Tiley, student of arts from South Africa, he stayed. He went through our two-year program, but he stayed and went to grad school. And for many years, the PTR helped him with tuition. He spent parts of two summers working for Dennis. Mm-hmm. The PTR has a tennis magazine called Tennis Pro Magazine. We had Dennis, we were on the cover. And he called our program, which is a nice tribute, the Harvard of Tennis Teaching.
Harvard, yeah.
Pakya Khan, Harvard Yad. With, at that time, Ferris State, you know, our program started in 81, Ferris State in Michigan started a little bit after that. And initially, it's how competitive it was between the USPTA and PTR, is that there was no way the PTR initially was on the Ferris State campus. Mm. And, but Dennis is a great friend of the program. Jim Lair, an article I wrote, an article I read on the educational merit of the USPTA. Boy, we have to get this right. The educational merit of the PTR,
yeah.
Dennis Vandermeer.
Yeah.
Firm and friendly. Okay, a firm and friendly learning climate. A consistent model displayed on a moment-by-moment basis. Learn by doing.
You don't get that too often anymore.
What is that?
A consistent model displayed.
A model strokes.
Yeah.
No, I think it's an injustice. We talk about Mike Larscheid and his idea of print, cursive, signature. Mm-hmm. We agree this is a shape of A. This is a sound of A. Can we print first?
Yeah.
Can we start with building blocks? Can we count and then add and then subtract? A little bit of logic. So at Jim Lair again on Dennis's work, constant and immediate feedback. Effective use of positive reinforcement. With no sugarcoating. It's honest and it's constructive criticism. I mean, if it's crummy, it's crummy, but why is it crummy?
Yeah.
Use of visual feedback. Show them, you know, in show and tell. So Dennis, yes, he was a showman. Mm-hmm. You know, when you teach tennis, especially peer teaching, the show is first. You don't say anything, just show.
Yeah,
the staff modeled what they taught. I can remember when I was working for Vic, they had some courts in the back, and sometimes there would be some substitutes that had to work because special project. There was extra mm-hmm. people there, and, mm-hmm. and my job was to go tell people, "Excuse me, you have to hit on the back courts.
Yeah,
Vic does not want anyone they see you hit the ball."
Well, and that's the bonus of being able to play well is that. Obviously, it's going to have an impact on your students if they go, wow, you can really serve.
But just to demo well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we train coaches, and when they come in, we don't make it mandatory. If they say, no, they don't want to do that. We recently had a coach who came in, didn't want to be filmed. That was fine. But you don't have to be playing. We're just going to feed you a few balls. You don't even have to move more than two or three steps.
Yeah.
But we want to just help you with your demo because communication is supposedly 70% nonverbal. Mm. Dennis had missionary zeal for practice. So Lair wrote that. Practice. At the, you're talking about the logic of his lessons. And
yeah.
Dennis would always say you need to And lastly, with a thank you. Thank your student. Mm-hmm. But you would have to issue homework.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to play if you don't practice.
Right.
It's like somebody, okay, I'm going to take piano lessons, but I don't have access to a piano.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
Yeah.
It's like the languages in the U.S. in high schools, for example. You go in for 45 minutes. It's a, you know.
You got to speak.
I used to get A's in Spanish. I mean, I've worked with so many kids that are valedictorians. And mom and dad come and visit, and I go, yeah, your kid's got 5 years of A in French, but they can't even order lunch.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to practice. Unique and creative procedures. You know, how to engage everyone, how to have practice partners. No one's standing around. Everyone's totally engaged.
Yeah.
This is so important. And this stands the test of time. Jim wrote, his work will always be relevant. The concepts and fundamentals, they stand the test of time.
Yeah.
Practical, in an approach that goes from simple to complex. And actually, his genius is that at the end, you don't think anything's complex because he just breaks it down.
Breaks it down.
Dennis would come to Tyler, Texas, and fly into Dallas. We'd pick him up, and he would just ask, okay, what are the variables? And I remember him just saying, okay, no problem, no problem. Again, confidence. Okay, I can do that. Mm-hmm. He could handle whatever we threw at him. And he could handle it all. So starting on the weekend, we would have 150 to 200 people. We'd have coaches come in. You know, we had the college campus, and we had the courts, and if we had to go inside, we had the lecture halls. Mm-hmm. But we'd have teaching pros, parents, players, and just tennis enthusiasts. You know, Texas has Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, El Paso. So especially in Texas, people from around their surrounding areas would come. Now, during the week, we'd have, I say, well, Dennis, we've got this going, but we have a PE class coming right now. So the PE classes weren't canceled. And, it was no problem. Everybody in the PE classes, 20 to 30 people. So people have to realize the great base. So I show up, I'm 26 years old. I don't think by any means that I'm one step ahead of the class. When I first got there, the curriculum had to be revised. There was a class called water-related sports. And I go, I'm not teaching water-related sports. So I remember going to the YMCA, talking to the leader, the director of the aquatic department, mm-hmm. said, I'll tell you what, I noticed that you have two tennis courts. I will build a free tennis program for you. And we will pack those courts, and it'll be free. This is what you have to do. Twice a week, I'm going to bring a group of students here. And we are going to cover, it was the maintenance of the pool and the chlorine and teaching swimming classes. And I was just not going to get in front of the group and going, okay.
Yeah.
Be, one page ahead of the students.
When Dennis went to Tennis Tech and Tyler, how long were his visits? Were they a week long or how long would he typically come? And
No, he would be there. 7 days.
7 days.
He'd be there.
So it was
7 a
week.
Days. Yeah. He would be, I have to think, okay, on the weekend, he'd come in and then, Monday through Friday, it was a lot we had to get done because we had to test the students.
So I just felt a little bit like, so he would come at 7:45 and you go, no, he would come at 7:45.
With,
Dumb and Dumber. Anyway.
We had on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we had a community clinic with at least 80 people.
Yeah,
we had guinea pigs, and they went on and all became really good junior tennis players.
Yeah.
To digress on that, we had the parents, almost all the parents built backboards at their house, a real wall.
Nice.
And, we had the enrollment grew to where we had 100 people, so we could find matches at every level. For the young players. And, I worked with them privately, but they would come out and they would be part of the community clinic. But we'd set it up. Okay. There's one court here, there's a set of bleachers and all these stations. And the kids actually took lessons and it was like they were on stage. They're hitting balls and people are taking notes on how they're learning to hit the ball.
You're used to playing in front of people, right?
Yeah, but the respect level. You know, I just think of some of those juniors, small town, less than, 10 guinea pigs. For a short period of time, it was really the second 5 years of the program. The program produced more state champions than Houston and Dallas combined.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, yeah, Dennis Vandermeer's coming in, and then Jim Lehrer's coming in, Vic Braden's coming in. It was really a special time.
Yeah, sure.
With the test days, Dennis would tell his students, if they couldn't so we have all these variables, numbers. Mm-hmm. And I dealt with that on a regular basis. So Dennis, this is Dennis, he sits in the room and he tells his students, so say the largest point we had, like 108. Dennis tells them, if they cannot bring three students, if they can't recruit three students, this isn't really fair to librarians. You need to get out of tennis teaching and become a librarian. You have to be very quiet to be a librarian. If you can't get three students here. So, we'd have these test days. And Dennis, they would all, so 300 plus would show up.
Yeah.
And Dennis would entertain them all on two courts. While we had 12 courts, there'd be testing on the other 10 courts.
You need it, right? I mean, you need in the testing body.
Well,
you know, 108
we didn't
people need that are going to take the test. They need a group lesson.
We didn't need 300 more, but
do the math.
But Dennis just knew how to make tennis happen, and we just his skill set could not be forgotten.
Yeah.
So he'd entertain and educate everybody on two courts of testing on the other 10. Dennis loved the crowd, and the crowd loved him. There were so many test stories. With, I remember a student came up to Dennis, and he had a lefty in his group.
Yeah.
And he said, Dennis, I have a lefty. What should I do? Dennis said, no problem. I'll take care of it. He says, why don't you go over there and get the ball hopper? And he called all the students over, and he had all the righties play lefty, and the lefty plays play righty. And he goes, I fixed it. So then he started. And so now the young guy, he had
got one righty.
He had four righties that had turned lefty and one lefty that had turned righty. Mm-hmm. But he certainly had fun, challenging people.
Yeah.
I remember I only tested visitors. I didn't really want to test the students. I once tested a student and I skipped the playing portion.
Your own students. Basically.
No, I didn't want to test that. We'd call them tennis techers.
Yeah.
So I was giving them grades. I didn't want to be the person saying, well, you're a P1, P2, P3.
Yeah.
And we talked about that, as you mentioned last week. But Dennis calls me up, and this is in Pete Sampras's book. Pete doesn't like the word lousy. Mm-hmm. My mother used that word all the time. That's lousy. Mm-hmm. So Vandermeer calls me up, and he goes, you are a lousy tester. But that's the thing, just to take care of it right on the spot. You know, to be reprimanded, that's something I certainly learned as a young kid. You just have to say, I understand. Mm-hmm. I understand. I'm a lousy tester. But what I had done is I had mailed the written test, and I'd written the evaluation form for the group lesson. But what I did, I was just pressed for time, and I didn't set up all the ropes and targets and fee all the balls. So I mailed the video in, just mail the coach I trained hitting balls, playing.
So it's like, hey, look, he's a decent player.
No, so yeah, okay, he has models. Yeah, he had model strokes. So anyway, what happened was, the video arrived, a couple of days later. Mm-hmm. And young people need to learn this. Is that so? Dennis called me back up and he goes, I like that idea of videoing. Maybe we'll do that. Hmm. But it wasn't like I was ever looking for a thank you or an apology.
Yeah.
And to me, I just looked at it as an honor. I go, Dennis Vandermeer is calling me up, it's just to be in that situation. I think a lot of times when a young kid, or a young coach, they're being criticized is their ego gets in the way. Mm-hmm. They try to defend themselves. I think one thing that's really important, Bear Bryant, and then Nick Baldieri copied Bear Bryant. Bear Bryant said, hey, I'm tired of being the grizzly bear. called his coaches in. He goes, "We're not going to be successful unless we're all grizzly bears." He goes, "You guys are a bunch of teddy bears."
Yeah.
So Nick, at one point, he just would be screaming at his coaches. And he goes, "If, you know, there's, you know, you want to create a fear factor. Like, I mean, if I don't get around this 400 in under 75 seconds, they're going to make me do it again."
Yeah.
And, but no, I don't think, you know, I don't want to say that Dennis was creating a fear factor, but lousy was lousy. Mm-hmm. There were certainly some confrontations on the test. There's always a few hiccups. That's just the way life is. I knew Dennis just a few years before pre-Pat. And so when they show up the first time, people have to realize, like, who practices giving lessons? Who does that? Well, yeah. We did. Yeah. We had a three-hour lab. We had 15 hours a week.
Yeah.
You know, 5 days a week.
With the guinea pigs.
We're practicing. So I have, you know, gone through the used PTR, I'm certified and I'm training people, but Dennis was forever tweaking it. Like, you remember, no, you guys are a little bit off. And well, this is what you were doing in 79. This is 81.
Yeah.
But there was some things where, you know, because in some ways we threw so much at the students, you know, they would, you know, like, say, for example, instead of having the racket on edge, they would have the racket face closed.
Yeah.
But with each passing year, our level went up. And, we really, you know, by the time people were there a second year, you know, sometimes Dennis, you know, he'd have a person who's pretty new to his staff serving as a tester.
Yeah.
And, but we got to the point where, you know, some of our students would have known more than the tester. That was, you know, that was something that was a ditto with the USPTA. But here's something, for example, our students could give a PTR lesson, which was very organized, okay? And it was just the serve, the forehand, the backhand. I mean, the ways to teach the volley, whatever you were assigned. But we'd have our students give a PTR lesson during a USPTA test.
Yeah.
And usually, I'd say almost never did anyone even know that this guy just got a USPTA level one and he gave a PTR lesson from beginning to end.
Yeah.
But the USPTA, it was, you know, just more open-ended. Dennis used to say, well, if you're a surgeon, you got to at least know one way. Okay, first learn A, then we'll learn B.
Yeah.
That's really what the standard method was.
I'd be interested to know now what, I'm not a member of the PTR, but just to know what their parameters are, what their checkpoints are, how much it's changed.
Yeah.
I'll have to look into that.
Well, it's like, you know, I look forward to interviewing or having a podcast with Jim Lair. He listened to podcasts we had on him. And we just, as first year listeners, we want to get through the pillars behind the great base. And to go back in time, you know, someone like Jim Lair's gone on and done so much, and his work has continued to develop. But just what he did during the 80s stands the test of time.
Yeah.
You know, when he was a clinician, and, you know, how did he run camps and how did he, you know, take the concepts of mental toughness and incorporate that, you know, applied information, not just information.
Right.
Dennis, he hired many of my students over the years. Dennis very seldom fired anyone. And I try to.
I know the punchline of this one.
I try to follow the same. What's the punchline?
You would just find him a new job.
He'd find him a new job. He'd find him a new job, but he found him a very good job.
Yeah.
But Dennis wanted to have an A.
Yeah.
He wanted to have an A. I think of Dave Anderson, you know, right in that East Texas area helping us. And, you know, but he had autonomy, ran a program in the neighboring town. And he worked for a gentleman by the name of Dick Tucker. Dick Tucker used to say, "I just want A's." Mm. You know, I got it. Every staff member has to be an A. I can't have a B. So excellent versus good.
Yeah.
Dennis, you know, definitely wanted to know his staff members were neat and organized, you know, not to be a slob behind the scene. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, Dennis used to tell people, you know, you can't look like you just came back on a fishing trip. You're really on call 24/7 as a tennis teacher. Yeah. So, you know, whether it was in a dorm at Sweetbriar, this small school in Virginia, small college, or townhouses, condos on Hilton Head Island, you know, Dennis did have real estate holdings, quite clever, where the pros were paying off mortgages. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it takes more time to be sloppy than it does to be neat. Dennis, you know, some people could have found this to be a problem, but wanted to really know how they live their lives outside of tennis. Mm. You know, a lot of ways, the personal, the professional, it all becomes one.
I've heard you say before, like if you're an employer, you're, you know, a tennis director, and you're looking to hire a pro, that you should also interview the spouse.
Yeah, that's
for sure.
For sure. You know, I used to tell my students, well, that's an assistant pro haircut. I don't really mind that. This is back when I had hair. Mm-hmm. Or if, you know, someone got a tattoo or someone got an earring, I said, well, that's not a problem for me, but there might be a committee. You're sitting down. And it's like back in the day with McEnroe, he used to be endorsed for big razors, but he didn't shave.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, you can, if you win Wimbledon, they'll pay you thousands and thousands of dollars to sell razors, even though you don't shave.
Yeah.
But the teaching pro, I think, has to be wired differently. Mm-hmm. Progressions. Build strokes and parts, gradually length method, GLM. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, you go to a conference and I think it's a novelty to, you know, the new system with the transition balls and the short rackets, short courts. It's not. I mean, years ago, people used to take wooden rackets and cut them off. So you'd shorten the racket,
right?
Shorten the court, shorten the stroke. People would put tennis balls. I used to do this. Is you put tennis balls in a washing machine, and then you take a metal brush. Mm. They're wet, and you just try to fluff them up. Just the opposite of what the pros want.
Yeah.
The pros who want a fast surface, fast ball. They don't, you know, like say at Roland Garros, you know,
pilling.
If it's wet, you know, the courts are damp, that ball's going to pick up moisture and it's going to slow the ball down.
Yeah.
So anything to slow the ball down. Dennis would back chain with teaching. In other words, he'd start at the end of the stroke and work backwards.
Right.
You know, like racket on edge. I mean, we were doing that with some kids today.
Yeah.
Like tapping the racket on edge, turning the racket out.
Yeah.
And we do one drill all the time. We just call it the Vandermeer drill, where you just turn the racket, the 180 degrees, you go out and you bring the racket behind your back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the racket path is definitely a second serve. Dennis with palm up, you know, he'd have kids, you know, approach the ball where you can hit it on the wrong side of the racket, wrong side, right at the last second, the correct side.
Yeah. Wrong side, right side.
You know, Dennis would show the picture. Here's just like a jigsaw puzzle. This is what it looks like. Here's the picture of an efficient forehand.
Yeah.
And then break it down into parts. But, I mean, he was an educator. He knew that you don't want to get stuck on a progression because then the brain is programmed.
Yeah.
But
even with brain typing, we talk about that. If you get intuitive people out there, they're going like, let me just, you know, show me the big picture. But then you got the S's that go, well, I want to see it piece by piece.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to first, first go in, hey, we're going to, let me just show you a picture of the forehand, and then you break it down so you can appease both types.
So yeah, he's well aware that you didn't want to lock someone into progression. Dennis, for example, back in those days, it was straight back versus loop.
Yeah, racket back and down.
Dennis would win people over. He was clever. If someone took the racket straight back and he wanted them at a loop, he wouldn't say, okay, your last pro was wrong. He'd say, no, let's just add to your game and let's teach you the drop shot. And then now have disguise, start with a drop shot, and then just go around and go up.
The racket up high first with a drop shot and then just go around.
So progressions are done, you know, it's just temporary. And then you're learning in stages and you move on.
Yeah. Chunking, right? I mean, really, it's just like you would learn anything.
Yep.
Do it in chunks.
With, like, say, ground strokes, start at the contact point. You know, you can do this with adults. You can say you're teaching one-handed backhand, they just put their arm over the net.
Yeah.
then you create a partner. The partner just tosses the ball. So now they can't have a backswing.
Yeah.
And now just lift your arm up.
Yeah.
And your partner catches the ball and they toss it back to you.
Yeah.
That's where you have to watch someone. That's where you have to observe. That's where it needs to be, you know, hands on to watch someone like Vandermeer operate.
Again, the art, the practicality of it all, what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah.
The practical application.
But what we could do is we could take Vandermeer progressions and then take some of the Vic Braden concepts.
Yeah.
So that's what we tell people is that what the great base is, it's a system of systems. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's no secret that we have students, and it's not just in this country. They get to the point where they're good enough to go work with the Federation. They go work with USTA coaches.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done that, Canada, Germany, England, other places. And they'll say, well, the great base is just one method. No, it's a blend of methods.
Yeah.
Or you need to modernize your game. Braden versus Vandermeer, that would come up all the time. Hmm. Back at that time, they were both huge. They were 1 and 2. And I would say throughout the world.
Yeah.
Throughout the world in tennis teaching. Yeah. Braden had a little more fame because of TV.
Right.
You know, Vic, there was two different times he had a show. We're going to talk a lot about Vic.
Yeah.
In wrapping this year up with podcasts. I mean, Vic was on talk shows. Vic was on a TV show called Hollywood Squares.
Yeah, Hollywood Squares was cool.
And I've never been able to, I've looked on YouTube where you basically ask a question and boom, you have a funny answer. And then the person,
basically you have an answer that's either true or false.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they have to go like, do you believe him or not?
Right. But Dennis was much more connected with the tennis teaching industry. His method was patented. To me, there was no one was better than the other. I remember Dave Eddy, who had a big influence. I mean, he was the first pro I met. I said, I could make a living. I could study tennis, travel around the world. So I'm in Miami and trying to think of the name of the place. It'll come to me in a second. So I'm at this place where Connors and Garolaitis, they're living at this place. And so I'm hanging out and I end up having a beer with Fred Stolle. And Dave Eddy said, this is my friend Steve, and he's an expert on what Vic Braden does and what Dennis Vandermeer does. Fred Stolle says, great, send me your resume. I'll put it in file 13.
Yeah.
Maybe I've said it before. Just throw it away. Dennis certainly, I mean, he was a very good tennis player, but if he were on the court, I go, this guy could flat out play. He could put a ball on a dime. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's always hitting balls. Mm-hmm. Vic was a very good athlete. You know, he was a high school quarterback.
Yeah.
And he starting guard and he won the Michigan State High School Championship 3 times, played at Kalamazoo. He played like, say, the level of Jimmy Everett. But here's a guy. Well, yeah, I played Bobby Riggs. I will get into to Braden, but they weren't world-class pros. And then that's another area where they would take their shots. Here's something I would say that, and it, get pieces of people mad at me, but overall, a Vandermeer pro would work circles around a Braden pro. A Vandermeer pro, at the end of the day, they had to at least make 5 phone calls. We have to connect. You have to connect with 5 people, call them up, talk to them about what we do. Mm. Dennis, Vic used to say that, my coaches show up a minute before class and they've got a racket, their sunglasses, and that's it.
Which court do I go to?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Which court do I go to?
Yeah.
What rotation am I doing today?
And, with certainly when you mention Dennis Vandermeer, you always have to mention Jim Verdick. But that was part of our tennis tech training is show up with a clipboard. Hmm. Vic used to just be wowed by our coaches showing up with a clipboard 30 minutes early. And, how can I do to help this out? Hmm. So Vic, in the end, he didn't really have a national, or I should say an international, worldwide network of coaches. Mm. You just think back at that. know, the PTR was really needed. Like, okay, how can we apply this information?
Right.
With that, you know, so I think with a lot of times just with the, you know, the, if you were just to look at videos and with any coach, you're looking at videos, like say YouTube clips today. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, you're telling us how you hit the forehand and you're demonstrating, but okay, how do you go from one to step two to step three? And, you know, what are the progressions?
Exactly. The practical application, right? I mean.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, mentioning Dennis and Welby, Dennis, to touch upon this, instant tennis with Dennis would put a tennis ball down in like field hockey where he grew up, ice hockey where I grew up, there's a face off. Mm-hmm. And you know, you just take one racket against the next, then you move back with your partner and you just try to tap the ball and hit one ball on top of the ball that's on the court. That's your net. Mm-hmm. And then you get two tennis balls. So back in the day, back when tennis boomed based on the tiebreaker, you know, you have 7,200 square feet. So Dennis typically would take two courts. So he's got 14,000 plus feet. Mm-hmm. And he would get people to rally. So then they would go over the net. And, you know, for Dennis to take a racket, the progressions, and, you know, you just, so goes your palm, so goes your forehand. You take your fingers, your thumb. And then you have a partner tossing you balls and okay, that's a forehand volley.
Yeah.
And then you just go down, graduated length method.
Yeah.
With Dennis's work, I think that he would always be in a position where he's building the drill. Okay. We're start to do this and add this. And then you can just see how
tennis is going to progress.
Tennis would progress. Tennis would grow.
Yeah.
I think with, you know, maybe this is good for part one. You know, maybe this ends up being part two, part three. But again, those that are looking at our content online, those people that have looked at our courses, we have the course Tennis Intelligence Applied. Mm-hmm. It's 25 hours. I mean, it's just so much Dennis Vandermeer information.
Yeah.
But I think it's very, very important to give credit where credit's due. And, let's start again next week with this for our listeners. But if you want to add anything.
No, it's been, I think, a good introduction to Dennis. You know, just what I see in the Great Bays, you know, from the day to day is definitely, you know, the group dynamics. I mean, obviously, like we talked about, you know, we're obviously going to talk about Vic, but, you know, a lot of times it was just the private lessons or one-on-one where, like you said, Dennis was a master at the group dynamics. So I see that from a day-to-day, you know, the group dynamics and then the progressions. Vic definitely had progressions. I'm sure all the other coaches that we did as well. But, you know, just, okay, here's key positions, progressions. Those are kind of the two big areas that I can still really see the influence. And then also the corrective measures, right? All the different creative ways to get somebody to go from point A to point B. So,
well, I think when it comes down to the private lesson, private lesson is expensive. We need to find ways to make tennis less expensive and simplify it. Can people get out? Can they practice in the driveway?
Accessibility.
There's so many things. The leaders, the people that are in the boardrooms making the decision how is our game going to be managed, the growth and welfare of tennis.
Yeah. I think it's too, just going back, you know, we say back to the future, but to go back and study someone like Dennis, all the information, all those videos, I mean, with Santorum or whoever it may be that has that kind of stuff, it should be saved, it should be archived and should be studied. And you go, hey, what can we go back and learn from these guys? You know, obviously they were giants in tennis teaching that's still relevant today versus just trying to reinvent everything, you know, the next gen forehand or whatever it may be. You say about Vic all the time, Vic is missed and he was missed, you know, and I think it could be the same thing with Dennis. I mean, there's lots of things that just shouldn't be forgotten.
Well, I think to some people, you know, unless they really do their homework and they watch what we do online, they look at before and after pre-post videos, teachings, information transfer, where's the information come from? But I think, though, the two of us, we certainly can come across as being too egotistical. Like, we know it all. But no, it's not what we know. It's what we've learned. Yeah. And we're just trying to share that. I don't know why. I mean, I could elaborate and take a few shots at it. But I grew up playing ice hockey. No one in the world of ice hockey would say that Bobby Orr could not play in today's game.
Yeah.
With
Also, I think, you know, when you see tennis teaching online or some tennis teaching online, you just kind of know where that's going to end up, you know, where you just see certain things and you go, well, that's not going to end up where they want to end up, you know, because it's just experience. I mean, obviously, you know, you're older than old. I mean, you're so old, but no, you've been in the game, what, 40, 50 years. I've got 25 plus as a teacher and then, you know, a little bit of playing as well. So there's some experience here, but so you just kind of see it. You just go, well, I know where that's going to end up. And it's not where you want to be.
Well, the experience, if you were to add the experience of the eight pillars we have in the tennis intelligence applied course, we mentioned over 100 coaches. Yeah. We just watched the NCAAs, men and women. And it was, I mean, the other day I did a little video work for one of the people who was in the tournament. And just to watch a few points, I did the video work from the NCAAs after we looked at a tournament, after we looked at two players that are playing national 18s.
Yeah.
And it's boys versus men.
Yeah.
You know, the 18s, these are boys playing, and then the NCAA, these are men. These are grown men.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think when people look at the internet, you know, like Jimmy Connors, for example, he won the NCAAs as a freshman, you know, early 70s. So now we're in the early 2020s.
Yeah.
So 50 years ago, and granted, he's playing with the T2000. People look at the speed of the ball in these videos, but Jimmy would have done okay. 50 years ago, the way he was playing, he would have done okay in the NCAAs this time around.
Got to the semis, I mean, the U.S. Open when he was 40. So he did okay.
Yeah, I think that's just another way like, to go with the history of tennis. It's like Rosewall in 54, gets to the Wimbledon final, Connors and then he plays Connors in 74. Connors almost goes another 20 years where he's knocking on the door. He's in the semis at 91. So there you take two guys, it's almost 40 years.
Yeah.
Stay close to the baseline, have short, compact swings, be able to play an approach shot, go to the net, do the math.
Yeah.
We can continue next week. But thank you, Dennis Vandermeer. It's so much for tennis. And we'll end with that. But it's just fantastic that he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll be back with the next part of Dennis Vandermeer next week. Stay tuned.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you, listeners.
All right. Thanks, everybody. See you in the next one.